Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group, talking to you today from somewhat sunny Northbrook, Illinois. We have a very, very exciting show for all of our listeners today. We hope you'll stick around. In addition to the usual cast of characters, my co-host Jim Marty of Bridge West, based out in Longmont, and Rob Hunt of Lene Holdings, based in San Diego, and I'll give them a chance to say hi in a minute. We also have an exceptional guest today, Noah Potter, an attorney in the cannabis space, is where I first met Noah, and he also has a strong interest in all things psychedelic as they relate to psychedelic law, psychedelic everything, legal marketing and strategizing and miscellaneous, as he likes to say. So we're excited to have him on. But let's get started. We have a lot of great Grateful Dead stuff to talk about, some big anniversaries of some shows, some old, some even older. But let me start off by joining in first with my co-host Jim Marty from Colorado. Jim, how are you doing today?
Very good. I'm in a very good mood because we broke through yesterday and got our tickets for Mexico in January. Dead and Company.
Congratulations. I'm still on the wait list, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I figure if you and Hoban are in, it's just a matter of time. I got to get there too. So good for you. And from California, Rob Hunt. Rob, how are you today?
I'm terrific, Larry. Thanks for asking. And another big week in cannabis. So excited to discuss that and all things Grateful Dead.
Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, let's dive right in. I think that we've got so much to talk about with Noah today that I'd kind of like to start there. We can circle back around to our cannabis stuff and our Grateful Dead stuff in a few minutes. Noah, psychedelic law. You know, everybody thinks that you know, those of us that are in cannabis law are kind of like cutting edge. But psychedelic law has kind of really taken it to the next level. What got you there and what's driving you to do it? And tell us a little bit about what you do exactly in that field.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Larry, and thanks for having me. Pleasure to meet everybody. 2010 came around, and I was going through some life changes, and someone serendipitously met on the train said, "Oh, you should create a blog." I said, "A blog? Okay." And my office mate said, "Sure, I know how to make a blog. Here you go. Here's a blogger blog." And I said, "Great. What am I going to call this thing?" I said, "Psychedelic law, because we need one. I mean, there kind of is one, but people don't know it. Know there's one. So let's just name the thing. There's a law of psychedelics. There's a law of everything, fundamentally. You know, you and I know that. Everything in the world is classified as some kind of law, one thing or another. And, but you just got to give a name to it. There's aviation law, there's maritime law, there's contract law, there's matrimonial law. You get like securities and derivatives and options, et cetera, et cetera. You got tax law. But it's like there's this thing called psychedelics. There's this phenomena called psychedelics that is stuck in the law, is embedded in this bad place in the law. So until we peel away, like unearth this thing, like, you know, find all of mycelium or if like some kind of concept like that, or, you know, pull out, I don't know why you want to pull out the root of the truffles, but whatever, pull out the fungus and dust it off and see what this thing is. And that was my goal in coining the term psychedelic law. I don't know, is that helpful? I mean, I can go into more specifics, but...
Well, no, why don't you tell us, what are you doing specifically professionally right now within the umbrella of what you're calling psychedelic law?
So, truth to tell, I mean, I'm in the practice of law. I do law stuff, but my focus in psychedelics policy and law, etc., is advocacy in New York. I've co-founded an advocacy group called New Yorkers for Mental Health Alternatives, the goal of which is to effectuate progressive psychedelic law reform in New York State. So right now I'm in an advocacy space. I have been blogging at Psychedelic Law for the last, I don't know, 10 years or so to try to provide, you know, offer fundamental principles of what psychedelic law is. But in terms of the active non-legal work, the psychedelic stuff is going on in an advocacy space to evolve psychedelic law in practice.
Who are you representing? I mean, what type of individuals, groups, specifically, who needs a psychedelic attorney? besides all of us.
Well, okay, Larry, so you want to get into it. So that goes to what's in the psychedelic space. What's in the, you know, you can call it, space is a little bit fruity, perhaps. There's psychedelic market that's kind of like not quite right. It's problematic in some ways for a lot of people. There's psychedelic sectors, like, okay. But I'm thinking in terms of a psychedelic economy. And there are different people who inhabit that space there. And those people are not necessarily talking to each other, probably not to a large extent. They probably, a lot of them don't like each other. It's a strange Venn diagram. The space in which, the place I've been occupying is on the state and local level decriminalization work. Part of what I've done relates to Denver. I assisted the executive director of the Decriminalize Denver campaign in 2018. At an early stage of the campaign, which was assisting him, and by extension the campaign, with getting approved the language of the ballot initiative, shaping it up something the Denver Board of Elections would accept, because the activists had not succeeded on, I think, two occasions. And so next go round, that's how I came into it. It's basically the place I want to be in advocacy. And it's kind of gone from there. So I've been at this point, networked in with that level of advocacy, with that zone in the psychedelic economy or psychedelic sector. There's also a researcher population. There are the people that I guess have come up along with, you know, kind of in tandem with MAPS, with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. That population of researchers that brought psychedelics back into light and made the psychedelic renaissance happen by providing data, creating a buzz, reestablishing this field. They're doing their thing. They're in research institutions. They are, I trust, involved with, affiliated with the pharmaceutical companies, the psychedelic pharmaceutical companies, and who are linked with the psychedelic sector investors. Now, therein you have, you know, then you have the people working in the ceremonial and sacramental realm. And there's, I think, a pretty strong overlap there in that, between that space and the decriminalization space, the state and local level. And, you know, Larry, between you and me and the attorney world, I break it up between people who are going for FDA approval and people who don't care about FDA approval. Like, just like in the medical cannabis space and more in the medical cannabis space, that's the closer analogy. Medical cannabis laws, licensees under state law, manufacturers, distributors, who care about the FDA? It's like irrelevant. They're doing their own thing. So similarly, there's a population of activists who have made Denver happen, made Oakland happen, made Santa Cruz happen, Ann Arbor, three different jurisdictions in Massachusetts. They're actively working in New York as well. And then you have the people who are going full on through the federal system, going the pharmaceutical route that cannabis has not been able to go and probably can't go for certain reasons. So all of those people need lawyers in some capacity. And I'm right. I'm not going in with, I don't think I'm going, I don't know what would happen for me to go to the FDA side, to that, to the medical world. I don't know, it could be. I'm in a different sector doing the advocacy work.
So, Noah, what are some of the medical uses or benefits of psychedelic substances?
So, I'm going to say, with caveats, the discourse, we'll call it that, because there's multiple facets to it, around psychedelics, talk about uses in treating substance abuse, and that would include nicotine, includes alcohol. A big topic of conversation is PTSD, anxiety, depression, treatment-resistant depression. anxiety is interesting, particularly with regard to the geriatric population. Well, I shouldn't. Geriatric and others, right, in the zone of mortality, where none of us are exempt. But it's applications for end-of-life anxiety, end-of-life distress. That's a big one. There's like, I think that's like a 7 billion person population, you know, consumer sector, maybe. So, yeah, it's expansive. And that's why there's so much buzz. That's why people are going around talking about this psychedelics of the new cannabis. And you have a bubbling, boiling psychedelic investment press, advisory platforms, and stock trackers regarding psychedelics.
And what state is the research in? How far along is the research into these various benefits of psychedelics?
I don't know if I was kind of hoping you weren't going to ask me something like that. Because that's actually a zone which I need to dig a little bit more for the purposes of moving forward on one of the two tracks that my advocacy group does. I'm going to need to boil that down and really, like, you know, focus it in. Suffice it to say that there are phase 3 clinical trials of MDMA for PTSD. That's my recollection of where MAPS is. There are just so many clinical trials going, sponsored so many different pharmaceutical companies. I think a bunch of there are studies in phase 2 clinical trials. Yeah, I mean they're administering in human subjects. So you're in 2 and you're in 3. You're out of 1. In terms of volume, in terms of, I mean, if you want to know if anything's gone through the FDA, all the way through the FDA approval process and is applying for its NDA, no, I don't think so. I think farthest along are MAPS and Compass Pathways, I think. But again, this is we got to talk about this later because I'm going to have to drill down into this. I've been doing decriminalization for the last like 8 months or so, and now I'm going to have to get real serious into the psychedelic assisted therapy side.
So, no, I remember when the cannabis movement first got off the ground and people were talking about medicinal cannabis. In many ways, you know, now that we've actually watched the industry go through the evolution that it has, you know, cannabinoids are certainly used for therapeutic purposes, and there's no doubt that cannabinoids have efficacious qualities to them. But ultimately, the legalization movement was about adult use recreational cannabis, and now we're really, you know, seeing that happen. And a lot of the things that people said early on of this being this, you know, camel's nose under the tent was largely true, and most of us in the industry knew that at the time. It was just getting people acclimated to the idea that cannabis is a substance that shouldn't be criminalized in the first place. With psychedelics, you know, sort of the same idea. You know, I love psychedelics from a recreational standpoint. I used them recreationally for years, whether it was, you know, mushrooms or LSD or MDMA. You know, I was happy to take all sorts of substances in a non-clinical setting. Do you think that this whole movement is largely following the same path, that, you know, this early days of, quote, medical psychedelics is just a gateway to adult use legalization?
Well, thank you for all that. First, let me say, in terms of the relationships between substances, you know, I have a whole lot of blog posts banging around in my head, desperate to get out, that can't get out because there's other stuff that needs to be done first. But one of the next ideas I hope to articulate is that fundamentally, the whole thing is one big mistake with a lot of little pieces. And by that, I mean drug prohibition. I mean criminal prohibition of psychoactive substances outside of alcohol, nicotine, caffeine, and then the whole spectrum of pharmaceuticalized substances. So, I mean, that is across the board. And that's why there's a burgeoning, all drug decriminalization movement coming fast. Having said that, so there's a special relationship between cannabis and psychedelics, in my assessment. And on a very simple, objective level, the federal schedules, and the one which I'm familiar, which is New York state schedules, puts cannabis in as a, quote, hallucinogen. So it's in the same part of the law that where you've housed LSD, MDMA, which itself is a question as to why it's in there as an amphetamine, DMT, mescaline, etc. So there is a certain kind of, there's an overlap. And I would say that a strong cannabis edible should be deemed a psychedelic substance, at least in terms of a paradigm of delayed onset, very, very powerful change in cognition and mood, and long lasting. But cannabis partakes of multiple qualities. And I guess the psychedelic phenomena, and I'm going to leave aside distinctions between MDMA and acid and psilocybin, for example. They're hybrid entities, they're hybrid products. And I quote myself in saying that fundamentally a psychedelic substance, the bottom line in psychedelic law, is it's a good that travels in interstate commerce. It's a consumer product that travels in interstate commerce that's subject to certain various considerations relating to risk and benefit. But neither one fits neatly into the existing categories. You have cannabis as a food, a medicine, and a euphoriant. Like, how's that work? Because you have foods over here, and then you have drugs over there. Once in law world, once you have two terms, it implies that they're different phenomena in some way. So, but this is the question for cannabis. Well, is it a food or is it a drug? And the answer is yes. So it doesn't work. And psychedelics similarly have hybrid qualities. It is a hybrid phenomena because they can partake of a sacramental practice. They can partake of a medical practice. They can partake of a wellness practice. And they can partake of a something maybe like the euphoriant aspect of cannabis. But the sacramental one is a knockout. That, you know, cannabis has continuously failed. Nobody's been able to my knowledge, get a religious exemption for cannabis of some kind. The courts just swat that down. Psychedelics have done that for a variety because of qualitatively different legal issues. Now, what does that mean to your question about adult use? I don't know what that means with a psychedelic. How do you do a, quote, recreational dose of a, like, I just don't even understand what that means. I don't think that paradigm works for psychedelics. I think that you could, if you're looking at psychedelics as a consumer as a consumer product, I don't think things are going to go well. I think that's a bad idea, personally. I mean, you're gonna try to increase market share of your psilocybin product with billboards and like celebrity endorsements.
No, I agree completely, Noah. You know, my opinions are, you know, upwards of 20% of the adult population enjoys cannabis. When you get into other drugs like psychedelics, you're getting down to 1% of 1% of 1%. So there really is no market share.
So two things. One, I don't know the numbers. I've seen a study, which is somewhere open in my browser, that actually calculates, describes a fairly high number. I was talking about 10% of the U.S. population has taken is ingested a psychedelic substance sometime, and that's excluding cannabis. Is best of my recollection. I mean, if you think about the MDMA phenomena, if you think about the rave phenomena, and you are going with this colloquial terminology, including MDMA as a psychedelic, I can see that being a pretty good chunk of the population. I don't think it's population use size is worth considering if you look at the idea of mass marketing, like a pharmaceutical, like. Some of these psychedelic pharmaceutical companies get their way and they take a product and they get through the clinical trials and they get FDA approval. Is that going to end up on television? Are they going to be marketing as like, hey, come here, fix your depression? So you may be looking at a huge market share, and that's why they're talking about hundreds of billions of dollar valuation of the psychedelic. No, seriously, there are hundreds of millions of dollars pouring into the psychedelic companies. Absolutely, they're going public. But at the same time, you know, I can't speak for decriminalized nature because I'm not a decriminalized nature person. But my understanding of their perspective is there are hundreds of millions of people that could benefit from mushrooms, from psychedelic mushrooms, from ayahuasca. I don't know how you do iboga because it's like, you know, somewhat like endangered status in West Africa. So I don't know how you're going to do iboga.
It's a lot of fun to do, though.
I have an epilepsy diagnosis, so that's an exclusion criteria, and I don't know if I'll ever make it there, but I understand is good. So
I think we're on the same page. I would agree with you that probably 10% of the adult population has done a psychedelic once or twice, but that does not make a consumer product.
When I say consumer product, I'm speaking in a kind of a, like I'm speaking like a lawyer or trying to speak like a lawyer. I'm trying to like, this thing appears in the law. It's a thing you get. It's a thing you get. It's not a service. It's not real property. It's not intellectual property. It's the thing. You take it, you put it into your carnate corporeal body. It's this like carnate thing you touch, you put it in, and you get it from somewhere. It grows out of the ground. It grows in your little mushroom cultivator. It comes out of somebody's like, you know, beakers. So you're buying the thing, or you're getting, or you're going, you're partaking in a ceremony, and it's being provided to you, it's being administered to you. So in that sense, it's a thing that changes hands. So when I say consumer product, I'm not talking about the size of the population. I'm talking about like what the thing is for legal purposes. To quote myself, I wrote a piece called Psychedelic Markets of the Future. It's on the Chakruna website. If you go to my blog, I probably have my link to that article is 2018, somewhere in there, I guess, in which I make the case that that's where I walk through the exercise and say, that's what these things are fundamentally for legal purposes. You may have a small market. With the right messaging, you could have a very large market. It's relevant in the sense that as the laws change and the messaging changes and the public image changes, you could have a great increase in consumer size. I mean, the consumer size for acid in the 1960s was like 0 to 100 in 5 seconds, in a sense. So, which is potentially problematic in many ways. I have grave concerns about where psychedelics could go, which is why I think we need a psychedelic law.
Well, but see, what really resonates for me, I think, is a combination of what everybody's saying here, including you, which is that psychedelics are out there. They're not going to ever have the same type of universal appeal that something like marijuana has, or you know, alcohol or things like that. And as we say, maybe for the better. But for the people who like to do it, they really like to do it. And I think the biggest thing for them is, I'm not asking to be able to like have a nice clean dispensary. If I want my psychedelics, I know where I can go get them. I just want everybody to leave me alone, right? I don't want the cops. So if society takes the position that, hey, look, there's a little bit of medical benefit to it here, so we can decriminalize it, and the cops can say, fine, we're not going to deal with it anymore for right now. And the people who want to do it, you don't necessarily have to be interested necessarily in growing the user base. If it organically grows, that's fine. But if it doesn't, even those people who just like to do it once a week or once a month or once a year, whatever it is, I think there's a much better feeling of security that, hey, I'm not really an outlier with this anymore. You know, generally speaking, society is saying, do your own thing, just don't cause any trouble and have fun.
100%, absolutely. So, Larry, you're speaking about the decriminalization side, like part on the spectrum, and I think you're articulating the general idea, and I'll like tweak it a little bit and spin it back, which is that it's essentially empirically has been a self-regulating market. I'm not aware. You don't have like. Okay, you had acid was the most dangerous thing in the United States in the late 1960s, per Richard Nixon. You can imagine societal transformation. There's like a lot of cultural transformation, like in a very short amount of time. I mean, impacted all facets of society because it acts on consciousness, and consciousness is the necessary predicate for everything else. So when you tweak society, you necessarily cause a chain reaction and ripples out. But you don't now have this marker of like, it's not opioids. It's just not. It's not crack. But there are people using it. So in and of itself, it doesn't generate a lot of, it doesn't seem, I'm not a sociologist here or whatever, it doesn't seem to generate the externalities that other, even alcohol, that the other substances do. That being the case, right, people know how to use it. And actually, Larry, sort of the end of the piece that I wrote, Psychedelic Markets of the Future, I do discuss the União de Vegetal case, I'm going to mangling the pronunciation, from 2006, in which the court basically, and I mean, this was most interest to me, essentially recognized that in a non-medical setting, a psychedelic substance can be safe. You don't actually need, according to my read of that case, ultimately the you know, critical point is that the same substance is treated by different standards depending on the use. If it's in a ceremonial setting, the court is willing to say for the safety standard that it can be administered safely. But it won't take it out of, it hasn't been taken out of Schedule 1, which is high risk. It can't be administered safely under medical supervision. So, there's a different risk profile. You see implicitly that the market can regulate, the demand side of the market can regulate itself, essentially, implicitly. And a decriminalization approach, decriminalization is insane. So, you know, let's just start at that starting point.
Okay, let me dive in here, because decriminalization suggests the ability for people to be able to go out and obtain these substances and use them.
Correct.
But in order to go out and obtain them, you have to buy them from someone. Jim.
Right.
He just said Schedule 1. Are we talking 280E here for this stuff?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, you know, if I want to become, you know, I don't know about a license, but like an herbal seller, and, you know, the government's going to leave me alone necessarily, but I can go out and get different types of substances like this and sell them because my local community says it's okay for me, the IRS could come knocking on my door one day to do an audit and say, hey, we're here to tell you about something called 280E.
Well, that assumes they filed the tax return in the first place.
Okay, fine. Good point. Valid. But for purposes of this discussion, I'm going to say yes. You know, they're just radical enough to go ahead and do that.
Well, of course, 280 says Schedule 1 and 2.
Right.
I was going to say, the whole reason I asked the question no in the first place, I kind of went down this rabbit hole, is, you know, there's a huge difference between decriminalization and the companies that he's talking about that are doing public offerings right now and are raising hundreds of millions of dollars on this. And I look at a lot of those companies and what they're trying to accomplish and think, okay, this is the same thing that I heard back in 2006, 2007, with companies saying, okay, let's start getting off the ground. And by 2011 or 12, you had all these publicly traded cannabis companies that were coming out that were only medical. We're just here for medical. We'll never do anything else. Look, we wear lab coats. It was nonsense back then. It's nonsense now, right? For all those companies that swore they were only going to be medical and they were only doing it because they were trying to develop relationships with research universities and they were trying to, you know, cure all sorts of indications. Look, it was completely fictitious when they made those claims at the time, and I think it's completely fictitious a lot of these companies are making these claims at this time. So all these guys are going out there and saying, we're trying to open 50 clinics or 100 clinics, and we're doing it in a way where we're going to be only testing analogs of DMT or analogs of psilocybin, or, you know, pick the drug of choice, and saying, you know, we're going after very specific PTSD and other things like that. Look, if you want to tell me you're going after decriminalization, you're trying to gain market share, cool. But let's be honest with who we are and what we're trying to do. And I'm not saying there's no efficacious qualities to psychedelics. I'm a firm believer that there are. But I do have a tough time with people that go out there under false pretense to try to raise capital.
A lot to say about that. There's a lot to unpack there. So I'm going to say that legalization actually is an umbrella term. I don't know if I'm an outlier here in saying this, and maybe others have, I don't know, but anyway, from my perspective and my ignorance of having read all the material there is out there, I'm going to say that legalization is a spectrum, and decriminalization is a point on that spectrum. Commercialization is another point way, way, way down the ways on the spectrum, and this is actually one of the things I discussed in that article, Psychedelic Markets of the Future. And You have other places on that spectrum. There's decriminalization of the consumer, decriminalization of consumption, that's the term people have been using generally. And then you have decriminalization of the supply side. And drug policy, listen, people use the term drug war, people use the term war on drugs. There is no such thing. That's done. That was like a different period of time. That's not the terminology. Those aren't the thought constructs that support prohibition. My perspective is that it's actually medicalization is the fundamental foundational point of prohibition, because you have criminal prohibition and you have medical use as an exception to criminal prohibition. Once you get into the supplied side, that's where things get weird, because who's doing the supplying and what are their interests? How are they covering their costs? How are they getting something on top of their costs? How are they making a profit off of it? Or maybe they aren't for profit. Maybe they're not for profit. Does that actually work? I don't know. Are they small, informal, voluntary associations? Maybe. Are they collectives? Maybe. I don't know. But that's and that's why, I should say, where a lot of the action is, in my assessment, is in the small part of this space, and these are attorneys doing the work, who are talking about the nature of the market. And in a sense, I quote myself again, a lot of this is about market design. And that will be a matter of statute. You know, that will be what kinds of entities are permitted to manufacture slash cultivate, distribute to a consumer.
Call me an outlier. I used to use my psychedelics to get high and listen to Grateful Dead or listen to Pink Floyd or listen to other music, and nothing I liked more than walking into a concert, dropping a tab of acid and watching the world.
Dude, I think that the only entities that should be allowed to manufacture and distribute psychedelics are record labels. Just keep it to that. You, your own branded acid, you know.
Who was it, Rob, who's saying, I'll watch the world and melt with you or whatever? Right, that's pretty much the concept every time you went into one of those Dead shows, if it was the right one. And Noah, forgive us for just 1 minute here. Please don't go away. We're starting to run a little bit short on time, at least as far as Jim goes today. He's got some hot, important meeting that he's got to pop out of here for in a few minutes. So we just want to switch over really quickly to the musical side, because that's always so much fun for us to talk about as well. So much going on with the Dead. So much going on, you know, with live music again and starting to come on board. Hard to know where to start, but, you know, Rob, you and I were talking earlier today, and why don't you kind of lead us into where you were going a little bit, talking about the shows from the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl back in April of 91.
Yeah, I mean, some terrific shows that happened on April 27th and April 28th of 1991. It was Santana playing with the Dead, opening with the Dead, and then coming out and playing. So it's a great segue, you know, going from where Noah was talking about with psychedelics and kind of wrestling with psychedelics and music. If you want to talk about, you know, two legendary artists that were, you know, Bill Graham's two favorite artists to bring up in the early 70s and kind of staples of the Fillmore, Santana and the Grateful Dead were definitely it. And obviously there's a great deal of collaboration. They, you know, shared many bills together over the years, both at festivals and also, you know, kind of on the Fillmore stage. But that was the first time in the 1990s they got together. And I think if anyone was at those shows, they'll remember just an absolutely titanic bird song that was on the 28th, which is now officially 30 years ago today, which is just an exceptionally fun thing to listen to. And as I remember, I was relatively high in psychedelics.
Yes, we were. And then it was the first time I had ever gone out to Las Vegas to see the Dead. I know they had played a couple of casino shows before that. But, you know, to be there with that many Deadheads, you know, you talk about like a group psychedelic experience, and of all places, Las Vegas, Nevada. But the best part about it is when you're in the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl, you're as far away from the Strip as you can be. You're out like in the middle of Nevada. I mean, there's nothing there. There's sand, and from the seats in the theater, you're looking out and you're seeing some pretty awesome sights. And as I recall, one of the nights there was a big thunderstorm off or lightning from far away. You could watch, you know, and everything. And then all of a sudden the show's over and here we all are, you know, totally loaded up from this Dead show. And we all go back to the Strip. And now at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's 30,000 totally lit Deadheads walking up and down the Strip. And from some people's perspective, you know, maybe it's not that much different from a normal Saturday night in Las Vegas, but it was pretty cool. I had a great time.
Psychedelics were tailor-made for Las Vegas. You know, there's nothing better than walking the Strip and seeing all the lights and everything else that's going on. And I'm not an introverted psychedelics user. When I used psychedelics, I was a very extroverted psychedelics user, and I loved being in the, you know, kind of the mix. As I said to you earlier, Larry, I never subscribed to the Timothy Leary, you know, controlled environment LSD use. I subscribed to the Ken Kesey, let's go out and freak everyone out side of the LSD use. So if you're going to use psychedelics, you know, why not just go for it, embrace it, and just let people know that, you know, you're you're actively using a psychedelic, and you're going to have fun with it. And for me, it was like running around the desert or running around like cool outdoor areas or playing in the redwoods or doing other things that got me out and in the woods, and rather than, you know, sitting there reading Be Here Now. Like, that, there was never like this like Ram Dass like studying of like, you know, like, oh, look at this felt, you know, poster or psychedelic, like, you know, blacklight poster. Like, those people used to drive me nuts. They would want to sit in place and be like, hey, man, look at this, and stare really hard. I'm like, no. I want to go out and listen to music and play. So Las Vegas was a pretty good psychedelic playground.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and of course, this just ties into what you and I were also talking about a little bit earlier. If you want to talk about that in Las Vegas, you have to talk about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, because that was the whole concept of that book, was I'm going to go to Las Vegas, and this town is already so crazy that I can be even crazier, and nobody's going to tell the difference. I can drop in on a conference full of law enforcement officers from around the country, loaded up on about 12 different types of drugs, and to them, I'm just another crazy guy in Las Vegas. And it kind of gives you good cover. I like that.
Yes. Well, I wasn't at the first year with Santana, but I believe that of the 5 years they did those Silver Bowl shows, I was at three of them. And that's what I always loved about Las Vegas. In small town America, there's nothing to do after a Grateful Dead show. In Vegas, the party's just getting started, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. And Noah will appreciate this story. One time I was high on psychedelics after a Dead show, and I sat down at a blackjack table and played third base there, last position before the dealer, and I was absolutely clairvoyant. I busted that dealer so many times, the entire Slots of Fun casino was cheering for me.
That'll happen. All of a sudden, you know how to count it into a deck of cards. You don't know why, but you just can't.
It speaks into efficacy of psychedelics. If you want to talk about, you know, the efficacy side of the question, you make a lot of money off of it.
Until the casino figures it out and says, no, you're cheating, right? Because anytime the casino loses, you got to be cheating. So I'm sure for that, they'll be like, no mental telepathy in here, pal. Take your drugs outside.
Interestingly enough, if we all remember back to those days, at the time in Nevada, a single hit of LSD was a 10-year sentence. It was a zero-tolerance state, so it was terrifying going into that town with psychedelics, you know, with drugs in general. But I don't think it stopped too many people. It just gave you pause for concern as to, you know, what you're going to do and where you hid your things when you walked in and out of the venue. But Nevada was a scary place back in 1991.
Well, it was a scary place in 2006. We were there for the first Vegas. And one of the late night shows was Trey sitting in with Phil and friends over at one of the big casino auditoriums. I don't remember which one it was, but we went in there and literally people were sitting in there and you could see people lining up their joints. And one by one, the cops were coming up and pulling them out, not taking the joint away from them, grabbing them. They were gone. They were tossed out for smoking their marijuana. And that always just struck me as such an anomaly that when you're in a town where anything goes, They were like policing marijuana at a concert like I'd never seen anywhere else.
Another story of Las Vegas and drugs is the maids in the hotels. If you left your psychedelics tucked under your bed, the maids would turn you in.
Well, because they get paid. They get part of the fine that the hotel charges you for smoking in the room. They come in and that's always the tricky part, right? They'll search around for those ashes lying there, and then they'll turn you in.
So I ran the VIP area for that first Vegas, Larry. So I had the entire area next to the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl as my own kind of section.
We were there. We were VIP.
I was your host. So, and going back to what Noah said earlier, I ended up eating a cannabis edible, not by on purpose, but by accident. I walked into the production trailer, and one of the guys was like, hey, have you had any of these cookies yet? And I said, I haven't. So I took two of them and ate them. And about half an hour later, I realized that I was definitely really, really high, to the point that I had to grab my my co-VIP host and say, hey, man, like, I need to take half an hour. You know, he's like, what's up? I'm like, I got dosed. I'm like, I'm not sure with what. He's like, you didn't eat the cookies in the production trailer, did you? I'm like, yeah, I did. And he's like, yeah, those are, you know, heavily laden, pot cookies. So I ended up having an out-of-body experience for about half an hour, about as high as I've ever been, including, like, higher than most psychedelics, and ended up having to hide in a kid's, like, play area where no one could see me behind a fence in, like, a sandbox for a while to start coming down on that. So that was my experience first, Vegas. Yep. It was a lot of fun.
I was there also. I had a press pass along with my then 16-year-old son, Matt, And that picture that Larry has seen in my barn of my son Matt talking to Trey, that's a picture I took in the press tent at the first Vegas.
Yep. No, it was great. We were all there. It happened to be my birthday weekend. And that same night, the Cardinals won the World Series. So we were all sitting in the Palms watching them win the World Series in the Nine Steakhouse with Pete Rose. And he was telling us all sorts of stories about back in the day. The Cardinals win the World Series. We had a bottle of champagne come to the table. And then we just went off and saw great live music. It was wonderful.
Who did he have his money on?
Just really quickly here, we are reaching a point where our co-host Jim Marty has to hop off. Jim, we're going to let you go.
Yes, I have to go because I have a musical connection. Tonight is the 80th anniversary of the opening of Red Rocks. And that's why I'm jumping off now to head up there. And as a commemoration, the tickets tonight are 80 cents.
Beautiful. We'll have a great time and enjoy the rocks.
Thank you to the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yes, it's the Civilian Conservation, the CCC, did the renovation work up there along with the Army Corps of Engineers. So, yes, great work they did. Talk to everybody soon.
Great. Thanks, Jim. We'll see you next week.
So, Larry, continuing on, let's talk about the fact that Santana being at those shows was, if we want to keep the theme psychedelic, I don't think there's too many guitar players that had more of an impact on psychedelic rock than Carlos Santana and possibly Garcia as well. I know that Noah would jump in there and say Pink Floyd as well.
Jimmy.
And Jimi Hendrix, of course.
Yeah,
hands down.
Okay,
Hendrix.
Fine.
But during that period, there was a handful that were pushing music to new heights with kind of the idea of psychedelics in mind as they were writing that music or as they were performing that music, knowing that a lot of their audience was going to be relatively high and not just high on cannabis.
And part of it was you're just talking about two guys who just basically played the guitar better than anybody else doing it together. And Rob was kind enough earlier today to share a link with me, which I'm going to let him tell you guys about because I got about halfway through it and then I had to stop to log on for the show. And that's where I'm going back to when we're done. But it's just amazing to see these two, really guitar legends. Just tell them, Rob, you'll tell better than I will.
August 2nd of 1989. At the Biltmore, Santana was playing and Garcia sat in as a guest and played a couple tunes. But for anyone out there that's a fan of both Garcia's playing and Santana's playing, it's such an intimate, small audience. And it was basically the two of them just trading licks for about 10 minutes back and forth on a song called Get Uppa. And I think they played a couple other tunes as well. But when they first come on, anyone that wants to see the link, Google Santana Garcia Biltmore and you'll find it relatively quickly and then get to about the 12-minute mark. And it is just a straight fire of guitar lick trading between two of the all-time greats in the business. So definitely worth checking out.
Okay. Now, let's, since we always like to include our guests in the musical discussion, before we were getting on, we were talking with Noah about Pink Floyd, a band that he enjoys, I enjoy. I know Rob's a big fan as well, and I think that Pink Floyd really is a band that, although I don't know that people would necessarily call them a jam band per se, they certainly have the jam band characteristic, and when they go out there and start playing, they just go off into another space.
But almost the antithesis, Larry. Like the big difference between Pink Floyd and the Grateful Dead is that their music was very, very calculated. They spent a great deal of time in the studio to make sure that they got every note perfect. And when they performed it, note for note for how they did it on the album. And they're very, very true to their craft in that way. So they created something that was relatively psychedelic, but they also did it in a very different manner than the Grateful Dead did. There was no jazzy freeform to what they were doing. It was very much orchestrated.
Well, exactly. And that's actually the interesting part about it. You state that perfectly because it was almost as though they were trying to compose jams, right? They were actually trying to put the music together and they, their studio stuff, even, there was a lot of free flow of the music in ways that you didn't hear in other bands perform at the time. The fact that, Dark Side of the Moon basically plays like you could just play it all the way through. It's really that kind of a composition, and it's just fascinating to me. Noah, tell us about some of your favorite Pink Floyd stuff.
So, the truth to tell is actually kind of a quest of like, what kind of music will work for an acid trip? And I mean, my sense is, except for like the big scream, but careful with that Axe Eugene is all good until you get to the point where the guy the scream comes.
That song is about LSD. That song is about Sid Barrett's relationship with LSD.
Okay, but I was all right. Well, that's that if that's where you want to go on your acid trip, then I think I gotta say it's kind of like borderline irresponsible to do that to people, perhaps if they don't know that's coming. But but set the controls for the Heart of the Sun. Yeah, I mean axe warnings. But set the controls for the Heart of the Sun. I mean, I wish that you could just do that on a loop and have that go for an hour. It'll be like great, for me anyway.
I think one of the interesting things about Floyd is the early days. Like two albums specifically, "Saucer Full of Secrets" and "Piper at the Gates of Dawn," were really meant to be as psychedelic as you could make an album. But that was kind of like the San Francisco post Summer of Love music that would come in. That was done in a very contrived way to try to sort of freak people out. And I don't think that Floyd really found where they were trying to go until probably 70 or 71, where it just came much more naturally. It wasn't contrived to try to elicit a certain response until they got to the point of creating masterpieces like Dark Side, or I'd argue Animals as my favorite of just top to bottom, just an incredible album, where a lot of the sort of psychedelia was just natural without forcing it.
Well, isn't that not unlike Anthem of the Sun and Oxymoxa, right? I mean, two albums, and if you listen to them, I mean, they're very contrived in the way they're put together, and they do it, but they were the launching pads that eventually got them to creating American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, which are, in their own right, beautiful albums. And maybe, for a lot of these musicians, it was that, early, more psychedelic period that really kind of brought it all together and helped them coalesce into, becoming what they did. And we can all talk about the 27 Curse forever, but since Noah mentioned Jimmy, it's really almost devastating to think about how much we missed in terms of what he would have contributed to the musical world, and whether he might have ever himself kind of taken a step off of the heavy duty psychedelic path and gone into the more, American Beauty creative type of path, if you will.
I think he would have created genres we can't even imagine.
Yep.
Yep. I would agree. I don't think there's any way he can be that talented. I think both him and Dwayne, as far as losing guitar players early, both those guys, I think, were just at the beginning of what would have been just exceptional careers. If you think about the longevity of other guys from that period that were that good, like what Clapton did in his career and how different he was, at age 45 as he was at age 27.
I not seeing Dwayne Allman may very well always be my biggest rock and roll regret. He's an exceptional musician. We were lucky to have him for as long as we did, and the fact that his music remained, and really, although maybe this is appropriate to be discussing along with this topic, but who's to say that Derek Trucks isn't channeling a little bit of Dwayne Allman in him, and doesn't have a little bit of that reincarnation flowing in him? Because quite frankly, when you hear him get up, and when they had Trey playing with them at Lockett, and they were covering Layla, it was hard not to think that wasn't Dwayne Allman up there, playing those slide licks the way he was just ripping them off.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I don't think anyone else can do it quite the way he can. I think that when you're raised by the Allman Brothers, essentially, you're going to take away a lot of what Dwayne had. But Derek is it's so funny. Trey actually refers to Derek Trucks as the best guitar player in the world right now. And, that's pretty high praise coming from a person I consider to be one of the top 10 that's out there playing the guitar right now.
Absolutely. No question about it. I think that's very true. So Noah, what's next in the world of, psychedelics? You and I, were very lucky. We first got to know each other, Noah and I, working with the Hoban Law Group, Noah coming in as one of the New York Council. And as a result, and one of the things that we've always talked about, and we talked about this with Bob when he was on the phone, was that Bob was such a visionary, and still is a visionary, in terms of being, really that much farther ahead than everybody else in talking about what you're talking about, recognizing that there really is law here, and there's law that's going to have to be addressed, and people are going to have to face it, and manage it. And now, here you are kind of taking it on to the next level. And, you're kind of like going from the Wild West, which is starting to get tamed, and you're going even more Wild West than you were before. In two questions, realistically, where do you see this all going in a couple of years, and where would you like to see it go in a couple of years?
I'm going to say they got to be the same thing, because if anybody's going anywhere, we need a lot of work, because I may sound dramatic, but if I say it seems like the ship is breaking up, I don't know if that means anything to people, if they kind of like get where I'm going with this, but there's like, you know, the whole system is quivering, potentially, if you look around the world. We're told anyway, and some of us may feel it, that we're kind of confronting a few different kind of existential crises for like Homo sapiens sapiens. And there are those who believe that psychedelics could play some part in getting us, I'm going to paraphrase, I'm going to use my own terms, getting us to a happy future as opposed to an unhappy future, or a relatively or happier future where like things don't go as bad as they could go. And I mean, I'm one of those people, with a whole lot of caveats, which we can discuss, you know, whenever. I want to see, and like, maybe to answer your question more directly, I believe that pluralism in the market is necessary. You need a free market. You need a free market in the sense that people aren't getting in each other's way. And people who want to have a psychedelic experience in a medicalized setting, with a medicalized product, they should be able to do so. And people who want to have a psychedelic experience in a natural environment, under their own auspices and autonomy, based on their own experience level and their understanding and their discretion, they should be able to do that. And we don't want, I don't want to have anybody in the sector controlling the sector through intellectual property rights. And I don't want people who are, you know, the terminology entheogen versus psychedelic is something we didn't discuss, but it's, for me, it's extremely significant. I also don't want people saying, well, you know, Western science is like, I don't know about this science thing. Like, who needs science? I'm not saying that they're actually saying that. That's a great reductionist approach to what is maybe present to some extent in the decriminalization side, but ideas morph. And any idea, in my sense, I'm a poli-sci undergraduate, and I'm also, I'd like to think, a student of life, that you send the stone rolling, and it kicks other stones, and you don't know where those stones are going to go. So I have a great fear of what I call a psychedelic Pol Pot, who will say, you know, I am the messenger. I am the one who will heal you. And anyone who tells you otherwise is an enemy. And I have many students, and my students contend with the students of the other false messengers. So there's all kinds of weird places things can go. And so we all need to do a lot of thinking. And this is why I think the lawyers are especially tasked, and it's especially critical for lawyers to be in this space, to ground people. And, you know, and so I guess in a very crystallized expression, excuse me, I would like to make sure there's pluralism in the market. Very highly technical, perhaps. I would love to see autonomy, local autonomy, to the greatest extent possible. I personally believe that ultimately the only way this is going to work is if psychedelics are introduced to societies and communities on their own terms, with their own paradigms, and not have anything imposed on the outside. I mean, you do have to have some kind of fundamental societal norms. That's, again, another question as to, you know, basic principles of like human rights values, and you're going to have establishment clause, separation of church and state issues as the idea of a sacramental, spiritual, religious use of psychedelics evolves. I would like to see the sector manifest as to what it purports to be, which is a alternative to the last, like, whatever, I don't know, 10,000 years of human society or something. And there's a caveat on that as well. But we need truth in advertising. Because if the movement does not manifest its goals, then we're just a bunch of fraudsters. We're saying, you know, and we're selling spiritual quick fixes. We're selling, you know, I mean, God forbid, who knows what could be in the pharmaceutical sector on the medical side of the market. And I guess in the other piece, with the one of the caveats is this is a mass, essentially, no matter what the FDA trial, whatever comes out of the FDA trials, this is a mass experiment. This is a mass, it's not even a clinical trial. This is just a mass societal experiment in potentially greatly increasing the aggregate number of people who are using psychedelics or will have used psychedelics. But when has this ever happened? I mean, my understanding of the paradigm of the ancient uses, the traditional uses, it was a very, if you're talking about a ceremonial environment, you're talking about something highly controlled. You're talking about something presumably embedded into a value system. And you may be talking about a situation, my understanding from what I've read, is it was only the shaman, the intermediary with the spirit world who was using the psychedelic substance. So when we start talking about having, like, opening the floodgates, oh, I don't know what happens. Who knows what kind of stuff comes out? We saw what happened in a small way into the 1960s with transformation. And I'm gonna throw another piece of this in. I'm not gonna purport to speak knowledgeably about this, but I think you can pick up enough little indicators that we're looking at. I want people to be free to use psychedelics and not be wired. I don't want to have a situation in which the mental health intervention of choice is an implant of some kind. It gives you a little electrical stimulus just at the right time and the right amount, and it kind of like balances you out. Brain interfaces. You know, hey, listen, if that's the way the market's going to go, first of all, I think people might want to be like careful about that stuff and like think through where it could go. But I want to make sure that psychedelics are still in that market. I don't want to have the device side of the FDA obliterate the psychedelic zone of the FDA, and by extension other parts, because you're not gonna, you're gonna have, I mean, who knows what happens to the FDA if this paradigm evolves? You're changing paradigms of consciousness. You're introducing a new paradigm of consciousness that, like water, doesn't abide by normal. Doesn't respect boundaries. So where I'd like it to go, where it could go.
You know, obviously anywhere. It's an amazing thing. And can't thank you enough, Noah, for your time today and you know, agreeing to come on and you know, even going a little bit longer than we anticipated. But quite frankly, this is just too fascinating not to take advantage of. And we have somebody with your background and knowledge. Just really quickly, if any of our listeners want to get a hold of you, how do they do it?
Well, first, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. I love to discuss this stuff. People want to connect. They can message me through my blog, psychedeliclaw.com. That's a New Amsterdam psychedelic law. You can get to me, just go to my LinkedIn profile. There's some websites that are eventually going to come into being, but I connect with people through LinkedIn.
Well, wonderful. Once again, Noah Potter, thank you so much. And Rob, before we sign off, I do have to say, as Noah was sitting there mentioning and talking about the whole religious experience side of it, the other thing that you and I talked about is that Tuesday night will be the 49th anniversary from the Europe 72 tour of the Grateful Dead show in Paris, notable for its epic Dark Star. And I think if you have to talk about, you know, a quote-unquote like religious type experience, a place to be and a song to be united around, be really, really hard-pressed to find something too much better than that. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. And I think if there's any advice we have for our audience, it's maybe take 250 micrograms of LSD and sit back in their house and listen to that thing in its entirety, because you won't regret it. And if it bleeds over into the next night or the night after that, yeah, you could do worse. But you know, get real high and listen to some Grateful Dead.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and of all the Europe 72 tour shows, and there's so many of them, this one just really stands out, that the Dark Star is so epic. That a few years ago on National Record Store Day, the Dead released a vinyl album, both sides of it, which was the entire Dark Star from start to finish. You know, it kind of reminded me of, Jethro Tull, Thick as a Brick, right? You know, just one song, start to finish, all the way through, and you got to flip the album in the middle of it. And the only thing that interludes is, you know, about 2 minutes of drums, which is just enough to kind of bring you back to normal sanity. before they take off again for another 20 minutes of who knows where. So, yeah, it is good stuff. It is good stuff.
Maybe one of these days we'll convert Noah.
I keep hearing about Darkstar. I may just need to try it out and just, give it a shot, focus, and who knows.
Write a paper on that. Well, it actually was, I read a story years ago that they, an elementary school teacher in Portland, Oregon, went to her kindergarten class, and for art class one day, she put on Darkstar, and she gave all of them, art supplies and said, just write down, whatever you see, whatever you feel, whatever you're hearing. And they list that, they show the pictures that these kids drew and the things that they talked about. And it was just like they were tripping, and one of the things we used to say when we were tripping goes, oh yeah, when you're kids, you trip all the time. You just don't realize it. When you're an adult, you grow up, you need to take the psychedelics to take you back there. And maybe there's some truth to that, because these kids were, we're hearing things in the music that was just astounding, for kids their age to be picking up on and everything. So it's all pretty cool. Very, very cool stuff.
And this was a lot of fun, Noah. Thanks a lot for coming on. We really enjoyed having you on. It's one of my favorite conversations. I don't talk psychedelics too much anymore because I'm so cannabis-centric.
Hit me up. We'll talk again.
Definitely.
Beautiful. Definitely. Rob, what do we got coming up on Dead Stuff on future shows?
Oh, wow. I think we're going to talk about Bill Kreutzmann, I think, next week. He was born on May the 7th. So
75th birthday.
Yeah, it's his big birthday. We're going to talk about what he's up to these days with Billy and the kids and some of the other stuff he's doing, obviously, with Dead & Co. Talk about some of our favorite jams, which is, tough to pick out, as drummers don't get too many jams, but the Grateful Dead drummers certainly got their fair share.
They did.
So we can talk about some of the greatest things he did as a drummer, but that should be a pretty fun show too. And I know we've got some really good guests coming up. I know we've got my buddy Alex Beard coming up on the 12th of May. For all of you out there in the art world that know Alex's work, his studio down in New Orleans, we'll discuss some of his art and some of his craziness of being an artist in New York and in New Orleans. So we've got lots of fun stuff coming up, Larry.
Well, you're right. In fact, next week we have a very special guest, a good friend of mine and a true a cannabis business person, Andy Greenberg from the Bay Area, who's a co-owner of Society Jane, which is a group out there that caters to the women cannabis users of the world. Besides being a longtime friend way back from summer camp days and college days and a companion with the group at many a dead show along the way, Andy has the distinct honor of being the first guest ever on the Deadhead Cannabis Show. Way, way back when Dan decided that Jim and I were mature enough to finally start having some guests, and she was great, and I couldn't be more excited to have her back with all of this stuff going on. I think you'll find what she and her partner Sharon Krinsky have done is just nothing short of amazing in terms of building up this women's cannabis market in the Bay Area, and it's very, very exciting stuff. So once again to my co-host Rob, thank you as always, and look forward to talking to you again next week. Noah Potter, thank you very much for your time. Jim Marty, who hopped off a few minutes earlier to head over to Red Rocks, where I'm sure he'll have a great time tonight. This is Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group. Once again, thanks everyone for listening. We will look forward to having you on our show next week. Be safe and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.